Thanks very much, James. And the conference I was at a little while ago, I forgot to plug in my laptop, and it was rather embarrassing when I ran out of power partway through. So I did remember this time. It seems a little loud. Seems a bit loud to you? No? You don't mind me? Okay, I'll try and talk very softly. Right. So it's a bit of a tradition in keynotes to wax philanthropic and say lots of philosophical things about wonderful fuzzies. Now, I'm not going to be doing that. I'm going to be talking more about technical matters, but in particular, answering a fairly common question that I get in that we're asked in the Samba team how we work things out. And there seems to be an assumption by many, many people in the community, in the Linux community, that what we do in the Samba team is we use disassemblers or debuggers or other techniques to look inside Microsoft code to work out how things work. In fact, that's not what we do. That wouldn't be a challenge at all. And we really stay away from those techniques for all sorts of reasons. And instead, we use techniques that are somewhat different to that. And so what I'll be talking about today is, if I can get this to display on, yes, good, and both at once. So what I'm going to be talking about today is the types of techniques that we actually have developed over the last few years. And these techniques aren't specific to Samba or the SMB protocol. In fact, they have applicability to a whole wide range of protocols and even non-protocols, even when you're working on analyzing a device or analyzing some other interaction, anything, any sort of interaction on computers it might be relevant to. And so the theme of today's talk is really that there are lots of protocols out there that aren't very well documented, but please don't let that stop you implementing them. Now, there's many reasons why you might decide to decode or analyze a protocol to work out how it works. It might be a proprietary protocol, so there might be just no attempt at all to have any documentation. It might be, say, proprietary extensions to a public protocol. Maybe there's a specification, but you need to clarify the specification. I find myself that unless the specification is written in C, I find that the specification doesn't really say exactly what is supposed to happen in the protocol. And so you may need to clarify the specification, and these types of techniques can be used to do that, or it might just be a fun challenge. You might decide to deliberately ignore a specification because you like the challenge of working something out. And it can be a lot of fun, a bit of detective work. Now, the broad techniques that I'm going to talk about today are up there. So we've got the French cafe technique is the one I usually use when I'm describing in a short talk roughly what we do. And I'll talk about the French cafe technique in a minute. Then there's protocol dumpers, protocol filters, poke and physic, trial and error analysis, scanners, dual server techniques, and random attacks. I'm probably fairly well known for the random attack technique. I've used that with success on a number of places. It's a lot of fun when you get a success with random attack. It's a really good feeling. But that's actually not our primary technique. That's only used quite rarely. So I'll start off by describing what I call the French cafe technique. Now, this is really just an analogy, and the analogy, of course, is stretched to breaking point. But imagine that you wanted to learn French, and there are no books on French, there are no schools that will teach you French, and there are no Frenchmen who are willing to teach you French or speak English to you. So how do you learn French in that case? Well, the obvious technique is to go to a French cafe. They're reputed to have quite good coffee, so at the very least you'll get a nice cuppa. So you go to a French cafe and you start watching people. So you look at the people in the French cafe and observe what they do. You observe that somebody says some magical French phrase, and lo and behold, somebody appears with a cup of coffee or a latte, whatever. So then you might try, say, ordering a coffee yourself. So you try and mimic what's being done by another person in the cafe, and you try and use the same phrases that they do, and you might end up with something other than a coffee. You might end up with something different, but that tells you something. So you record everything that you observe while you're in that cafe, and from your observations, you slowly build up some knowledge of the language. Now, with network analysis techniques, of course, you can go a little bit further. You can do the equivalent of maybe assaulting the waiter. Now, normally, if you did that in a French cafe, you probably would learn a lot of French words.
There'd be a fairly strong response to that. But in the computer world, of course, the equivalent of that is to send random garbage to a server process to really attack the program and be fairly aggressive and just see what happens. And by observing what happens, you can learn an awful lot about how a particular protocol is supposed to work. So that's the broad technique, and really the French Cafe technique is a reasonable summary of the types of techniques we use in the Samba team, and are used by many, many other free software projects. Samba is not at all unique in the techniques that we apply. But on a less of an analogy, the you could call it perhaps test, capture, and stare. And this is perhaps the first technique that people apply to a new protocol. So they start off by setting up a fast turnaround, simple test. So in particular case, this was in fact the first technique that I applied to the SMB protocol. And what I had was a Windows machine, and I had the Turbo C compiler and on that machine, and then I had a SMB server. Now, in fact, it wasn't in fact a Windows SMB server, it was a Pathworks server, but the same theory applies. And what I did was I wrote a number of little tests, for example, a program that opened test.dat. And then you run that program and you capture the data going between your computer and the computer that's implementing the existing proprietary implementation, the Pathworks server, and you capture all that data and you stare at it. Then you try opening, say, test2.dat, and you capture that data as well, and then you compare the two lumps of data. And what types of things do you think you'd observe that are different? Timestamps, file names, yes. So lengths in particular. You might start learning about, for example, whether a string in the protocol is null terminated or whether it has a length prefix, because that's two very common techniques. It's common to either have a string that has a bunch of characters and you put a zero on the end saying, and that's the end of that string, we're doing something else now. Or in other protocols, you might have a byte or two beforehand that says how long the string that's coming up is going to be. And so by just doing that very, very simple test, you've quickly determined which technique is used in this particular part of the protocol. And that gives you a good idea as to, might give you a hint as to what's used in other parts of the protocol as well. Then you might notice, for example, that other values in the protocol have also gone up by one. And so there might be, for example, a framing of some sort in the protocol that says how long is the packet? How long is this particular lump? And there is in the SMB protocol, you notice that goes up by one. And then you notice that other bytes don't tend to change. Now, how would you work out what a byte means if it doesn't ever change? Exactly, who cares? So the technique that's used is that if a byte does change, then that gives you sufficient information about what it means, because when it changes, tells you roughly what the byte means. It gives you some clues at least. If it doesn't change, then you just hard code it. So the very, very first versions of what later became Samba had a whole lot of code in them which said things like, you know, byte 36 equals capital A for no obvious reason. And it worked. People actually used this in production systems, and that's because that byte in fact didn't change. Now, since then, of course, we now know what those bytes do mean. We've learnt that over the years, and as we've got much, much deeper into the protocol. And now we basically know almost every byte in the protocol. There's only a few exceptions. They're the ones that really don't change very often at all. But just noticing those small differences can give you an enormous number of clues as to what's how the protocol works. Now, in order to do this, you do need a very fast turnaround, so you do need to be able to design a new test, try the test, get a result, and move to the next one fairly fast. So it's a good idea with this sort of test capture and stare to be able to be using both a proprietary implementation on the server and the client. So this is assuming it's a client-server protocol. Of course, in other cases, you may have a different type of protocol. But in a client-server protocol, so you have the proprietary implementation, say, on your desktop and a server on some other computer, and they are talking via the protocol correctly. one presumes that they've implemented it correctly for their own definition of what the protocol is supposed to be. And so you're taking advantage of the fact that they are talking the correct language, they're talking French correctly in the French analogy. And then what you're doing is asking the client to make specific requests of the server and observing how those requests change when you change exactly what you're doing. So that's the basic technique, and that technique is perhaps in many projects that are attempting to analyze a protocol, people might stop there. And they might decide to just use those types of techniques. Now, in fact, you can go much, much further than that. And what I'd like to introduce to you now is the concept of a protocol filter. And this is one of the most powerful techniques. It's a fair number of important sections of the SMB protocol we've worked out by looking at protocol filters and or designing protocol filters for particular tasks. And then we use those to find out things that you can't just find out by observing correct behavior in the protocol. Okay, so what is a protocol filter? Well, at its simplest, a protocol filter is a small proxy. And it's very easy to write one. Typically, you can write one in 100 lines of C or so. It's just a little program that, say your protocol goes over a TCP socket. It might listen to it on a TCP socket, and when it gets a connection, it then makes a connection to another TCP socket, which is the proprietary server, and it captures all the data in between. That's fine. That's just like our previous one with test, capture, and steer, but it also might alter the data on the way through. So you have a little proxy in between that alters the data as it's flowing through. Now, you might think that you would need to actually understand the full structure of the protocol before you can sensibly alter the packets, but that's in fact not the case. The most useful protocol filters that I've used have been ones to just make global substitutions, for example, of strings. A recent example was I was working on the GSS TSIG, which is it's an enhancement to DNS, to dynamic DNS, to allow for encrypted updates of a DNS server. DNS, of course, the domain name system, and when a Microsoft client, a modern Microsoft client, registers or gets a IP address with DHCP, it will then register with the local DNS server, but it will try to do it in a secure fashion. It will try and use Kerberos to authenticate the registration of its name and IP address with the DNS server. Now, there is in fact some documentation for how they do this, but the documentation is what you might call a partial specification. It's not really complete, it's not really clear exactly how it works. And there weren't any public implementations. There was the one proprietary implementation that Microsoft had done in Windows 2000. And there was a couple of people from other companies who said they'd got it working but weren't releasing the code. And so we don't know the state of their implementations. So in that particular case, when you dumped the protocol, so you had a Microsoft client registering its name with a DNS server, if you looked at the packets, you could see some strings in there. And one of the strings you saw was GSS-SPNAGO. Another one was just GSS API. So these two strings were sitting in the protocol. And from those two names, they're both authentication protocols, those two names. SPNAGO is a authentication protocol and GSS API is another authentication protocol. So it's a fairly good guess that those strings are part of some sort of negotiation. So they're negotiating which authentication is going to be used between the client and the server. And so I noticed that the server gave back GSS-SPNAGO. It chose that particular authentication. And that's a more complex protocol to analyze than GSS API. So what I decided to do is have a small protocol filter that just modified the strings on the way through. So when the server sent a string to the client, the string was modified to just put X's over the last few characters. So when the client received that packet, the client thought that the server could do GSS-XXXXX and GSS API. So of course, the client then says, well, I don't understand GSX-XXXXX, so I can't talk that one. I'll instead talk GSS API. And so that way, by using a very simple filter that just did a string substitution globally across the packets, we were able to force the client and server to negotiate a different authentication protocol. And once you can force that, then it makes it much easier to do analysis. So for example, you can force the change in authentication and do a capture, then not force the change in authentication, then do a capture, and compare the two. Now, the bytes that are common at the beginning are clearly a common part of the protocol that aren't affected by which authentication method is being used, and then you start seeing some changes in the protocol. You see, okay, this is the point where we are authentication specific. Now, in fact, we had a lot more information because of the partial specification for this protocol. We, in fact, had a lot of other information about the protocol. It was a relatively easy task to work things out. But the ability to alter the negotiation between the client and the server was an extremely important component in being able to work out exactly how the authentication worked. And so a few days later, we had an implementation. I've released a quick implementation in Perl of GSS TSIG. So if any of you do need to do dynamic DNS, authenticated dynamic DNS registration with Windows 2000 servers, you can now do that if you download that package. So the other filter that we really commonly use in Samba, at least I use it in the Samba team, different people in the Samba team have different techniques, is a filter called SMB filter. Now, SMB filter is a little bit more sophisticated than the SockSpy filter. SockSpy was the one that's the name of the program I used to do the GSS API, GSS SPNOGO substitution. And in fact, SockSpy was also the same program that I first wrote to start decoding SMB back in December 91. So it's lasted a very long time. It was a very simple program. It's lasted many years, and I still use it as a workhorse for doing very simple substitutions when I need to work out something new. But SMB filter knows a little more about the protocol. It actually does understand a fair bit about the SMB protocol because we've come a long way since 1991. We now know a lot about how the protocol works. So we can write a filter that can make modifications in very specific parts of the protocol. Now, a good example of this is for a long time we were struggling with a problem that Samba implemented the SMB protocol using ASCII strings. So we negotiated 8-bit character sets on the wire. Potentially we could support multi-byte character sets, those variable length strings, but in most cases Samba was really being used for English and ASCII. Now, in the SMB protocol, a lot of things are negotiated. And one of the things that is negotiated is what character set is going to be used on the wire. And in particular, is it going to be an 8-bit or a 16-bit character set? So you negotiate whether every string is going to have 2 bytes per character or 1 byte per character. And we were suspicious in several cases where we got a different result to, say, Windows NT or Windows 2000, that perhaps the problem was caused by the fact that we were negotiating 8-bit strings and maybe Windows had a bug in not dealing correctly with clients or servers that negotiated 8-bit rather than 16-bit. And there were a number of cases where we proved that was the case. So how do we prove that's the case? Well, you can just say we could try and re-implement Samba using 16-bit, excuse me, 16-bit strings, and then we can see if the problem goes away. But that takes a lot of effort to do that, and you don't really want to put in that huge amount of effort to solve a bug for an immediate release if, in fact, that isn't the problem, if there's some other problem that's causing things not to work. So the first example we hit of this was where we found that Samba couldn't support share names longer than, I think it was, 12 characters. So if you tried to have very long share names, and then the Samba client could quite happily see long share names from the Samba server, but the Microsoft clients couldn't. Microsoft clients, when they talked to the Samba server, they just didn't see shares at all if the share names were longer than about 12 characters. And some users found this frustrating, but they wanted very long share names. So we wanted to find out exactly what was causing this. Now, we suspected it might have been ASCII versus 8-bit versus 16-bit characters, and that perhaps that Microsoft Windows had a bug in it where it couldn't handle longer strings if those strings were 8-bit in that particular section of the protocol where it's fetching the names of the shares. And so what we do is we set up SMB filter between two Windows 2000 machines. So we typically I use something like IP tables to direct the client at the filter, or in fact you can just use you can just put it in INETD and then you've got to play name games. SMB filter has got the ability to do substitutions on the NetBIOS names inside the packets so that you can in fact point it at the wrong IP address and you set up something like an LM hosts file on the client to point to force it to go to a particular IP address. There's many techniques of getting it to talk to the filter. IP tables is a particularly useful one. So you organize the Windows client, you make it point at the SMB filter. The SMB filter then points onto the other Windows 2000 machine. And you arrange the filter so that it just flips that one bit. There's one bit in the negotiation of the protocol which says, shall we talk 8-bit characters or 16-bit characters? And so you flip that bit on the way through. And then what you have is Windows 2000 talking to Windows 2000 in ASCII. Now, you don't normally get that. It's impossible to arrange because they always negotiate Unicode. But now we can see two Windows machines talking to each other using the ASCII variant of the SMB protocol. And at that point, we can start running tests. So we can, for example, set up a long share name, and lo and behold, you see that with just that one bit flipped, that long share names are no longer visible to Windows clients. So that answers the question, yes, our suspicion was correct. But there's been a number of other cases where we also suspected 8 versus 16-bit characters, and we found, in fact, that our suspicion wasn't correct, because we run SMB filter, a very simple test, and we find, in fact, it doesn't fix the problem. Now, that's in fact, an older problem in Sambra. As some of you may know, that the more recent versions of Sambra, in fact, negotiate 16-bit on the wire. We now talk Unicode in the current CVS and Alpha versions of Sambra, at least. So that problem is now gone, is well past. But the technique of flipping one bit and making the two proprietary implementations talk to each other in a way that they normally wouldn't is one that's very, very powerful. We also use that for error codes. There's two different error handling systems in the SMB protocol. There's the old DOS error codes, which are the ones that are documented, at least partially documented, and there's the NT error codes, which aren't really documented. By default, of course, Windows 2000, Windows NT talks the NT error codes, whereas the older clients will talk DOS error codes. And again, we were suspicious in a number of cases that perhaps a particular problem would only occur if you were talking DOS error codes. And there was, in fact, a number, we used the filter again to force Windows to talk to Windows, but with DOS error codes. And that allowed us to tell whether, in fact, that was the problem, and that allowed us to target our efforts at solving that particular problem. And in that case, we were able to solve the problems without a complete rewrite, because, in fact, you can negotiate DOS or NT error codes on a packet-by-packet basis. So once we discovered, using SMB filter, that a particular problem was caused by us using DOS error codes, then our initial solution was to recode just that portion of Sambra to use NT error codes. And then now, of course, our current alpha CVS versions are completely NT status codes. In fact, the current released version, the current 2.2 version, is also completely NT status codes. But that allowed us to move there slowly, knowing which portions we needed to target without having to do a complete rewrite. So protocol filters are a very, very powerful tool. I'd highly recommend them to anyone trying to discover new things about a protocol. They're surprisingly easy to write. You're welcome to grab SockSpy as a generic protocol filter that can just do string substitutions. So you can just grab that from my junk code site, junkcode.sambra.org, you may find it very handy. Okay, so this next technique is one that we don't use all that often in Sambra, but in fact, I first used this technique when I was working on the TiVo, and I was trying to work out the structure of the TiVo file system. And this technique I call poke and physic. And any of you who are system administrators, of course, will be familiar with physic or E2FSCK or all the equivalents for the various file systems. I'll generically just call them physic for here. The physic programs on many operating systems are quite verbose. They will give you a whole raft of information when they find errors. They'll say, you know, this cluster lost or that name too long or whatever. They'll give you all sorts of information, buddy map corrupt, lots of things. It's just the nature of programmers to tend to print out nice messages when they get unexpected conditions. And I'm very, very glad that they do. And I've also noticed that it's quite common that proprietary implementations don't strip out those error messages before they ship. And so the trick is, of course, is learning how to trigger those messages. Now, if you were going to cheat, you'd go and look inside the binaries or something and find the list of messages. That's cheating, and it doesn't also tell you the conditions under which they happen. The decoding the MFS file system on the TiVo, the technique that I used was to, I read a little program which poked, MFS poke, and it poked one byte at a particular offset in the file system. So it just took, it said, which file system do you want to poke and what offset? And it would then, and take a value, say, what value do you want to poke there? And it would just blat over one byte in the file system. Now, obviously, this didn't contain, you know, my favorite videos or whatever that I was poking over. So I'd poke a byte, and then I'd run the physic program, which is normally run on for sort of extraordinary conditions on the TiVo when they've had a major disaster or something. They run this physic program. They don't normally run it on startup because of the way the file system works. It doesn't really need it. It's a synchronous file system. But they do supply the physic program with the TiVo, and so you poke the byte and then you run the physic and you look for revealing error messages. So you poke a byte and you notice it comes back and it says something like, you know, buddy map too short. Aha, it's got a buddy map. Okay, that's useful, and there it is. I know it's at that location in the file system. Or it might say something like, you know, checksum wrong in directory. I say, okay, I know that there's a checksum involved in the directory entries, and I know that in fact I've just blatted it out. So I could go searching for the other byte that makes up the checksum. So you leave that byte blatted, or you blat it the same way, and then go try changing other bytes until the checksum is now okay again. You get a different corruption. So that's assuming they use a simple additive checksum, which in fact is what they were using. So you can get all sorts of revealing error messages out by just trying and poking bits and pieces and seeing how it reacts. So this is like the metaphorical equivalent of the going and assaulting the waiter, I suppose. And it's an extremely powerful technique. I would caution you, however, if you're going to use these types of techniques, it's tempting just to sort of poke and listen and poke and watch and things and not record your results. It really is important to record what's happening because it's very easy 20 minutes later or, you know, the next day or whatever to have forgotten exactly which byte caused what message. Quite often I use the script command to keep a record of everything that's going on when I'm doing these sorts of experiments. And keeping those records can be extremely important for when you come back to things later. So poke and physic is a powerful technique. You can use it in some cases on network protocols as well. It doesn't just apply to file systems. Again, if you use a protocol filter like I described before, sometimes you find that the client or the server starts logging error messages. And in some cases, you have to actually find out how to enable the logging. For example, there's registry settings in Windows that enable logging in the various subsystems. And by setting those registry settings, you'll find that you'll get a fairly verbose log being put onto into the file system somewhere. And by then using a protocol filter to blat over particular bytes, sometimes you get very useful information as to what those bytes mean or how things work. So moving on, the next sort of level of analysis is what I call trial and error analysis. And now this one is a little bit more sophisticated, and this requires that you already have a fairly good working knowledge of the protocol, and you're trying to understand it a little more. You're trying to delve into the darker corners. You already know the rough structure. And the technique relies on the fact that in complex proprietary protocols, the error handling tends to be fairly regular. So for example, you get a, also more complex protocols tend to have more error codes. So there are many hundreds, perhaps even over a couple of thousand different error codes in Windows. There's huge numbers of error codes. And they use those error codes in very specific conditions. So, for example, if they fail to decode the initial framing of a packet, they might give you something like NT status invalid parameter. If they if the permissions aren't sufficient for an operation, they might give you permission denied. If it's a bad file descriptor, they might give you something like NT status invalid object. those types of things. And so particular error conditions tend to produce very specific error codes. Now, in order to take advantage of full error analysis in a protocol, what you need to do is, first of all, work out what each error code means. Now, that can be quite interesting, because if there's hundreds and hundreds of error codes and all you've got is a number, you know that sometimes the server will give you back error code 364. And what does error code 364 mean? You don't really know. You have no idea as to what caused that. And so the first task is to work out what the error code means. The next task is to work out the processing order of the protocol. So what I mean by the processing order is, does it first of all check whether the operation you're asking for exists, and then does it second authenticate, or does it authenticate first? So in what order does it do the processing? Because the error code that you get will determine at what stage in the processing of the request it failed. And that will guide you as to what you've managed to get right, and will guide you in your search to try and find out more about that particular portion of the protocol. So once you've got those first two pieces of information, it's possible to write a error-driven protocol scanner. And protocol scanners are something that we've only started on them in the Samba team a couple of years ago. But we found them extremely powerful. And so I'll show you one in a second how it works. But first of all, I'd like to address the problem of how do you work out what an error code means? Now, this technique, we used this fairly early on in Samba, and it's what we call error mapping. And the technique is really rather simple. What you do is you take your existing prototype implementation of the server, and you modify it to always fail a particular operation. So for example, you always fail deletion of a file, or to always fail opening a file, something like that. Or you might say that it only fails deletion of a file if the file name has a particular name. So, say for example, you modify your server to return error XXX if anyone tries to delete the file test_XXX.dat. Okay, well, XXX is a number, right? So that means that it's not very useful as a production server, because it means no one can store any file names of that name, but you don't ship that, hopefully. And there have been some mistakes in the past. But so then what you do is you ask the proprietary client to access file names starting at test1.dat, going up to test999.dat, however far you think the error codes might go. And the server then returns that error code. This is your own server. So why is that useful? Well, you see, the client, typically when it gets an error, will want to display that error to the user. And so, for example, if you open up a DOS box, a DOS shell, and you try and del test_37.dat, then what it will say is out of quota, or whatever a 37 means. And so it will end up printing out the string that describes that error. And that's because built into the client is a great big table somewhere that maps from the numbers to the strings. And so what we're triggering is we're pulling elements out of that table by running a batch file. We just have a little batch program in the DOS box, which tries all possible error codes from 1 to 1,000, and we output that to a file, and you end up with a list of all the names of those errors. So in fact, I might as well show you the result. That's in fact where this file came from in Samba. Should have had this prepared, of course. Right. So these errors, we can see here the numbers and the strings. In fact, this was auto-generated. The first version of it was auto-generated from an awk script running over the result of that batch file, and it gave us all the strings associated with the various error codes. And it's been modified a lot since then, and it's been, things have changed, but it gave us an awful lot of information about what the error codes mean. And that was an extremely powerful technique. You can end up with essentially some source code coming out from a DOS batch file, filling in a whole lot of blanks about the protocol that would have been very, very tedious to find out via another technique. And one could have perhaps found it I don't know, there might have been books or something that, that contain information about error codes, but heaven knows if they were accurate. And so by running the, using these types of techniques and getting the proprietary client to extract the information for you, you can find things out much, much faster. Yep? Possibly, I don't know. We don't do that. One of the things that we decided early on in the team is that we wouldn't actually disassemble, we wouldn't look directly inside the binaries. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. One of them is there's potential legal problems. Many people do this and it's fine, but Samba turned out to be a fairly high profile project and we didn't want to be a test case for any sort of grey legal stuff. And so we decided that we would stay well away from the disassembly type techniques, and instead we decided to extract information by watching on the wire. And there's quite a number of precedents to say that watching on the wire, observing the French cafe technique, is absolutely fine. There's no legal qualms with it. And so that we prefer to stay within those we prefer to steer clear of disassembly type techniques. But it means that, you know, there's some things that we're a bit stuck on. There's a couple of things that we probably could work out if we did, you know, resort to those types of techniques. But we have come a fairly long way without it, and so we'd rather persevere with the techniques that we've been using rather than going down that track. So that's the reason, really. Please do ask questions while we're going along, by the way. Yep? That can happen in some cases. For example, there are some places in the SMB protocol where there's error code squashing. So for example, usually it's for very good reasons. A good example there is in authentication, there are error codes for bad username, bad password as separate error codes. But in fact, the modern Microsoft servers won't distinguish between the two because that can be used to give information to somebody trying to find somebody's password. And so it's considered good practice in an authentication system if somebody gives you a username and password to just say authentication failed rather than saying, well, you got the username, but now have a guess at the password. So it's usually considered, you know, it goes either way. Some people think that it's fairly pointless trying to hide usernames because you obtain them by other methods so easily, which in fact is the case. Because in fact, in most Windows servers, you can use some calls called the LSA calls that are anonymous calls to find out a lot of information about the users on the machine. And there are some other calls that reveal who's currently logged in and that sort of thing, but it can be done anonymously. Those have been tightened up in more recent version of Windows. There's something called Restrict Anonymous that allows Windows to tighten down exactly what information it will give to an anonymous client. But they still do use the practice of trying to minimize the information given to somebody trying to log in. But those particular cases you can easily cope with on a case-by-case basis inside your little program. And in this particular case, the one I described just now, that in fact didn't happen because it was our server that was providing the error code back, and the client tends to just print whatever string is associated with that number. The next technique I'm going to be describing, which is due to Andrew Bartlett, his technique, did suffer from that error code squashing problem, but it wasn't a really significant problem because only two or three error codes were squashed, so it wasn't a major issue. So as I said, you need to be able to determine what each error code means, and you need to be able to determine the processing order and the proprietary implementation, and then you can write a scanner. Now, I've described to you the error mapping technique. The next technique that I've mentioned is, as I said, it was invented by Andrew Bartlett. And this is called proxy error mapping. I don't know what Andrew calls it that, but anyway, I call it proxy error mapping. And in this case, what you do is he had a modified Samba domain controller. So he set up a Samba domain controller, but he'd modified it so that it would fail authentications by user 56 with error code 56. And so that meant, again, it wasn't a very useful production server, but what you do is you then take a Windows 2000 client and you join it to the Samba domain. So you now have a Windows client joined to the Samba domain, authenticating via this modified domain controller. And then you take another client, and you typically it's like a client we write ourselves, like SMB client, and you try to authenticate to the Windows 2000 server. Now, the trick is that you configure the Samba domain controller to send DOS error codes to the Windows 2000 server rather than NC error codes, because the aim of this particular technique is to find the mapping between NC error codes and DOS error codes. Because we always need to know in our code if a DOS client attaches to us and we wish to produce a particular NT error code, if the DOS client has negotiated DOS error codes, we need to be able to give the appropriate code by mapping from the NT error code down to the DOS error code. Or if we had, for example, a place in our code where we're trying to return a DOS error code, you might want to be able to map it to an NT error code for a client that wants to talk NT error codes. So being able to map between these two sets is very, very important. And there are some of them you can guess. You can guess, for example, that file not found might map onto file not found. In fact, that was a bad guess, and in fact, it doesn't map onto file not found. It maps onto a object. What is the error code? Is Andrew here? Number B. Sorry, where are you? Yeah. It maps onto some other error code. It's NT status object. Invalid object, I think. Anyway, it maps on a different error code. In fact, there is a file not found in the status error code, but they don't use that one. They use something else. So we're very glad we had these types of techniques to discover this. So what you do is the client then tries to authenticate as user one. That gets passed to the Windows 2000 server, which then passes it on to the Samba domain controller, and the Samba domain controller deliberately refuses the authentication with DOS error code 1. Now, the... Okay, oh, that's right. He used the NT error code 1. That's right, he did it that way around. Okay, he gave the NT error code 1, thanks, Andrew, which is returned back to the... Sorry? Right. Right, we ended up getting that with a separate program, didn't we, running our Visual C program. Yep. Okay, so what you did is we returned the NT error code from the Samba server back to the Windows 2000 machine. Then our client had negotiated DOS error codes with the Windows 2000 machine. So the Windows 2000 machine, of course, was then given the task of translating the NT error codes to the DOS error codes, because it had a client that was talking to it that said, I can only understand DOS error codes. And it had a server upstream from it that was giving it NT error codes. And it had to somehow give a valid error code back to that client. And so by having a client that tries to authenticate as user 1, user 2, user 3, and then it observes what DOS codes come back, that gives us the mapping table between the NC error codes and the DOS error codes. And so that mapping table has been very important for the newer releases of Samba. And in fact, again, an AUX script or a Perl script or something was used to modify the output of that program and to turn it into a C file that contains the mapping table. Then similarly, we wrote it for the reverse mapping. We ended up using a little Visual C program because there was a function that was available in Visual C for doing the reverse mapping. So we were able to then call that function and take the output to get the reverse mapping. So that type of technique is extremely powerful. When you take those techniques, you combine them together a bit, you end up with something that we call a protocol scanner. Now, a protocol scanner is a bit of a strange beast. What it does is it connects to a server and it tries all possible operations within a particular area of the protocol. So, for example, we have a scanner called the Trans2 scanner. And the Trans2 is a bit like somewhat like IOCTL for the SMB protocol. It's sort of a catch-all that has a whole lot of stuff underneath it. It has 100 or so operations that can come within the single Trans2 operation. And then those operations contain a whole lot of different information levels, which are different forms of the structure that you want to get back. And each of those information levels requires different authentication. And so it might be an operation like querying the size of a file, querying the amount of space on the disk, that sort of thing. So these operations are, there's lots and lots of them, but they're in a very, very structured format. Okay, so the main trick with writing a scanner is knowing exactly what an error code indicates. So we connect to the server and we try each possible operation, operation 1 up to operation 5000. And we just pick a number there. It's just, you know, it's going to be way beyond the range of operations in this particular section of the protocol. And then what you do is for each operation, you try doing a trans2 level 1 and you try passing it a file descriptor. And you say, here's an open file descriptor, do you like that? And the server comes back and says, you know, that doesn't taste very nice, I don't like that, invalid object. And so you know that, okay, operation 1 doesn't take a file descriptor, right? And you're able to do this because it just so happens that Windows checks what type of object you're passing as the first test in trans2. It doesn't check whether the rest of the data is valid until after it knows that you've passed a valid object. So it doesn't matter what data you pass along with that file descriptor, you can just pass the file descriptor as is, and then the server will tell you whether that's in fact valid. So you then might try a file name, you might try a user object, you might try all sorts of different types of objects you're passing through to this server, and then until the server comes back and says, no longer says invalid object, it might say, for example, invalid parameter. Now once it says invalid parameter, then you know that you've got a valid object that you're passing. You know that it takes a file descriptor or a file name or whatever. And then after that, what you do is you then try different data sizes, because if it says invalid parameter, that usually means you haven't given it enough data. And so what you do is you try setting it, say, 2 bytes, then 4 bytes, then 6 bytes, it's always a multiple of 2, and you send it nulls. So you send it increasing amounts of data along with that file descriptor or file name or whatever until such time as the error code changes again. And when the error code changes again, you know, okay, I've got past that line of code in the server. We know that, in fact, it takes that much data. And you can keep doing this. You can slowly sort of wind your way into the protocol to work out exactly what a particular operation takes. And that can give you an awful lot of information about the way a protocol works. So I should be able to demonstrate to that to you, hopefully. So what I've got here is, we've got this program generically called SMB Torture. And the reason why it's called SMB Torture is quite interesting. Originally, our test client was called SMB Client, which seemed far more logical. And SMB Client was never intended to be a useful program for anyone to actually use in real life. And unfortunately, people started using it. And it's now turned, all sorts of people do their printing via SMB Client now. And so eventually we gave in and actually rewrote SMB Client to be a decent piece of code, because the first version of it was designed to be highly malleable, as in it was designed to make it easy to put invalid packets on the wire. So we just directly constructed the packets like at the top level, poked bytes in, and the idea was that when you wanted to see what would happen if you put a particular byte in a particular place, you just go and quickly modify that line of code. It was extremely convenient. But sometimes, of course, releases were made with those modifications in, which led to interesting results in the early versions of Samba, at least. And anyway, once people started using the program seriously for doing all sorts of things, backups even, we realized that it wasn't a good idea having our primary test program also being a program that people use seriously. So I started a new program called SMB Torture, and the name was to scare people off. I thought, no one is going to entrust their company data to a program called Torture. Anyway, so SMB Torture takes has all sorts of operations. The particular one that I'll show you here is a trans2 scan. So what I'm doing is I've got here a Windows 2000 server sitting there, and I'm going to scan it. Now, this scanner, in fact, we run this scanner regularly. When, for example, there's a new release of Windows that comes out, then we'll run this and see what new operations have come into the protocol. So you can see there in the result, it tried operation 0, there's nothing in operation 0, tried operation 1, 2, 3, and in operation 3 it found some interesting stuff. It's found, for example, that sending a void object, because there are many operations, for example, asking for the amount of disk space is a void operation, and it has level 1, 2, level 258 up to level 261, then up to level 1008. And it worked out how much data it required. In fact, all of those operations require no data. And it also reports how much data is returned. So this gives you a rough roadmap of this section of the protocol. Now, if we go down a little further, we can see, for example, that operation 5 in trans 2 takes a file name, because the error code changed when we gave it a file name, so it no longer said invalid object. And at that point, we then try the different information levels, and we see that, again, it takes reply parameters and reply data, and again, the actual data length is zero. But down here in operation 6, you can see you require some data. So that one, for example, you see level 1 of operation 6 takes a data length of 22, because until you give it 22 bytes of something, then the error code doesn't change. And so by giving it those 22 bytes, the error code changes, you've clearly locked in that next bit. It's a bit like decoding a combination lock, where you sort of try to find the next little bit. Then you see that it has a reply parameter of 2 and it takes no reply data. So it's obviously a set operation of some sort, and it sets 22 bytes of something. It's probably like set file information, something like that. And there are different variants of it that take more or less data, 4 bytes, 40 bytes, 2 bytes, etc. And we can keep going, and there's all sorts of different levels here. There's another thing called NT TransScan, and there's various other scanners we've got. And you can see that you can quickly build up an idea of how the protocol works and what different things are available in the protocol very quickly by writing a scanner like that. And so we've got we've got about 4 scanners, I think, now in the protocol, in the Samba tools, and we're developing new scanners, you know, on a regular basis. I'm working on a new scanner at the moment, a security scanner. So I had a question there? What we're doing is, if that sort of thing tends to happen, one of the things you need to be able to do is have a reliable and fast reset operation. And so it's quite common that inside the scanner we like totally reconnect the server with a new TCP socket between operations. Now in that particular scanner it doesn't, because it just so happens that that portion of the protocol doesn't tend to have consequences further down the track. But a later scanner I'm going to be showing you in a couple of minutes uses a technique called backtracking to determine exactly when something happened, because there's one type of scanner we've got where an operation mightn't cause any obvious change, but then, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 packets later, the consequences of that operation become clear, and you need to be able to backtrack to find out why, you know, when it happened and what was the root cause. So perhaps when I'm talking about the backtracking, it'll be a little clearer as to how we approach that. Of course, all the time, yes. And Samba servers, I should say, you know, crashing the Samba daemon as well. But yes, and of course we report those. There's lots and lots of times. We don't report it quite as often now, because we don't have as good contacts in Microsoft. It used to be that we could make direct contact with the appropriate programmers. There was a programmer in Microsoft in particular who was in charge of writing a lot of the SMB code, and or maintaining it at least, and we had direct contact with him. We met him at one of the early SIFS conferences. Unfortunately, he's left Microsoft, we believe. We haven't had contact with him, but I think he's retired. So we now do have some contacts, but they're not as close, and they may or may not respond to us. And they're also a bit, I think in that particular section there, they may be winding down the number of programmers they have working on this. Anyway, we seem to have less good contact these days, and so it can take a lot longer. And a lot more effort to try to convince them that there's a serious problem. Yeah, we particularly tend to notify them if we discover things where you can anonymously, you know, crash or reboot or whatever a server. They're the most serious types of bugs, and there's a number of cases where that's happened, and there's been a few hot fixes come out of Windows over the years that have been due to us discovering things like that. Sometimes accidentally, actually. There was a rather funny one with a university in Germany where we'd released a new version of Samba that had better support for browsing. This is a very early version of Samba. Better support for browsing and becoming a domain master browser. a local master browser was M8 at that time. And what happened was you could set something called the server string in Samba, which is the string that identifies a particular server. So when you see the list of servers in the network, it has this string next to it that says what the server's called. Now, this particular person in the physics department in a university in Germany had set his string to be, please don't use this server, use this other server instead, which is a very long string. And so Samba was dutifully announcing itself by doing broadcast packets onto the network to say, here I am, and please don't use this server, please use that server over there. And that string was rather long in German. The result was this guy then went home, and over the next two or three days, they had about every 20 minutes a new machine in their network would reboot spontaneously. They weren't even machines on the same, actually using this Samba server. It was just machines on the same broadcast segment as the Samba server. And when they received these broadcasts, if they were listening on that particular NetBIOS name, which means they were the local master, they were a local master browser of some sort, then there was a buffer overflow and they rebooted. And so once they rebooted, of course, they were no longer the local master browser, so somebody else became the local master browser. And so we had people whose secretary's desktop, they were happily typing away in Word and suddenly kapoom, they'd reboot. But it was quite a good bit of detective work by the admins there. I really take my hat off to them to work out what had happened, because it wasn't people using this Samba server that was causing the problem. He then notified us about that, and we fixed that bug, obviously. It wasn't actually a bug strictly in Samba, it was strictly a bug in Windows. What we did is we modified Samba so that it would truncate the string. Now, Microsoft also fixed things so it would handle longer strings, because there was no specific limitation in the protocol. It was just that their dialog box was only so long. They'd never tested with a longer string. So question up the back. I'm not sure. I'd have to look up my old email. I don't actually even remember it, but I archive these sorts of emails. I'll have to think about whether I tell you. Maybe I should email the person and tell them to contact you or something. Yep. Okay. So, back to scanners. So we've got this Trans2 scanner, and that's really very, very useful for working out, delving deep and finding new sections of a protocol, finding new operations been added to the protocol with a new release. The next thing I thought I might tell you about is a technique that was come up with by our Japanese Samba team member. And I thought it was a very, very clever technique. This technique was designed for working out the case mapping table for Windows NT. Now, the case mapping table, case equivalence table, tells you, for example, that capital A and lowercase a are the same character for wildcard matching purposes, or for when you do an open, for example, the opens are done in a case insensitive fashion in the SMB protocol in general. That you can, in effect, it's optional, you can in the protocol negotiate various other things, but in general, it's case insensitive. Now, so we need to know what that case mapping is. Now, in English, it's relatively obvious. Capital A, lowercase a, capital B, lowercase b, it's all fairly obvious. But in other languages, it's much, much less obvious, and there are some rather strange ones. For example, the fact that the angstrom symbol, physics symbol, happens to also be the Swedish o character. And that character in Japanese, in fact, when lowercase becomes an a, so you get these sort of strange effects with characters with really unintended consequences. And that's really just an accident of the way that the Windows does its case mapping. You might think that you could just look this up on unicode.org or something like that to find out the table, but in fact the table that Microsoft uses isn't the same one as is published on unicode.org. And so we needed to know what the correct table is, because otherwise we weren't going to operate correctly in languages other than English. And the technique that was come up with was this. What you do is you write a little program that loops over all possible Unicode characters, all 64,000 of them. This is only a 2-byte Unicode, UCS2. And then for each character, you create a file name containing that character in the file name. So you create the file on the server with that character in it. And then what you do is you write into that file the number of the character that you've just used to open the file. Okay? And then you keep looping. Now, when you open a file and the file already exists, then you know that it must be because an earlier character is case equivalent to the character you're currently trying to open. Because otherwise, you've deleted all files at the start. That's the only way it could have happened, that you've in fact found a match with an earlier character. So what you do then is you open the file and you append to the end of it the character number of the character you're currently processing. Then you keep going. Now, at the end result is you end up with 64,000 files, and any file that contains more than one number in it is a list of character equivalences. So you can generate the character equivalence table very quickly. So I might as well demonstrate that to you. That test is called case table, and we'll just run that against the Windows 2000 server. And so here it's trying each character, 0, 1, 2, etc. Aha! There it's found character 61 on this server is equivalent to character 41. And character 62 is equivalent to character 42, etc. We go down a bit further and we find some triple equivalences, because the equivalences aren't actually symmetric, and it isn't just one-to-one. You end up with actually, for example, you might end up with an accented character. When it's lowercase, it becomes an unaccented character. When you uppercase it again, it becomes the uppercase version of the unaccented character, and it loses its accent. So in fact, you can use this technique to discover that as well. And we should see, I think the maximum you have is 3 character equivalences. There's one. So character 3C3, 3A3, and 3C2 are all equivalent on this Windows 2000 server. So you can see the technique is quite powerful. It very quickly gives you that table, and the output of this we can immediately import into Samba as a case equivalence table that's just a data file that gets loaded into Samba. And we immediately know that we've got the exact correct mapping. Now, in fact, we were then able to ask the question, well, is the mapping the same in different languages? If we install the Japanese version of Windows 2000 versus the US version versus the, happen to have the Swedish version at home, and so got those three, and we were trying testing between the three of them, we found, in fact, that for the case table mapping, in fact, they're all identical. They used the identical mapping. But the valid character mapping was different, because what characters are valid in 8.3 short names is different between the different countries, but the case table, case equivalence table, was the same. So that was, a very powerful technique, and the result of that is in the current alpha versions of Samba. So was there other questions? Sorry, Swallow. The next one? Yep. That's fine. All we need to know, really, is whether two characters are equivalent, and so we can actually deal with it being equivalent to more than one. That's fine. You just got to know that that's a possibility in the code so that you can deal with it, but it's not particularly difficult as a programming technique. You have to have some asymmetric stuff in there to cope with correctly uppercasing and lowercasing, but in fact it's unusual in the protocol to require to actually uppercase something or lowercase something. The more usual question is this string equal to that string? And you don't really care whether that's the uppercase version of this. All you care about is, are these two characters equivalent? So you really just need a table that tells you that. Okay, we've got various ways of compressing that table and things, and there's all sorts of tricks, but I won't go into those just at the moment. Okay, so next thing I thought I'd mention is the problem of determining inputs. Now, this technique is often used when you're first looking at a new encryption method that's been added to a protocol. So there's a number of new encryption methods being added to the SMB protocol over the years, or a new hash or something, say a new signing method or a new sealing method. So before you can start attacking an algorithm like that, where the algorithm is completely hidden from view, the algorithm, the results of the algorithm as a hash might go over the wire, but a hash by its very nature, you can't tell anything about what went into it. That's the whole point of good, strong hashes. So what you do is you use a protocol filter between the two proprietary implementations, and you first need to answer the question, what inputs go into that hash? What things are munged up to make this hash? And so to find that is you selectively destroy each candidate element between the client and the server. So for example, you might postulate that perhaps the username is part of the hash. And so what you do is you try destroying the username as it's passed across, so the client and the server think they're using different usernames, which means they're going to each calculate the hash differently. Does that break the cryptographic link between the two? You destroy the machine name, you destroy the IP address as it's transmitted, or you fool the IP address. You change timestamps. Is, for example, the time that's sent as part of the first packet in the SMB protocol, is that time critical in the hash? So you try destroying that time or changing the time between the client and the server, and you observe whether they're no longer able to negotiate the signing correctly, for example. So by observing which elements, when you destroy them, destroys the relationship between the client and the server, you can very quickly determine exactly what inputs are used in the hash. And once you know what inputs are used, and you know whether the hash is size-preserving, for example, if you say it's an encryption technique and you might guess, well, maybe it's a stream cipher. Well, one of the things that is distinctive about a stream cipher is it keeps the size of the data the same, and because it's just XORing with a randomly generated stream. So if you notice that the size is kept the same, then you might guess that maybe they're using the RC4 stream cipher, and then you know that the inputs, for example, they does care about the machine name, it does care about the username, so perhaps they're seeding the RC4 using a hash of the following. Let's guess they're using MD5, or let's guess they're using DES or something to seed that hash, and you try a few combinations. And it's surprisingly how often you can actually work that type of thing out. It certainly gives you an initial handle on it, to where to start looking. So the final technique, the next technique I'd like to talk about is random attack. And random attack is one of my favorite techniques, but it's usually used to solve a very specific problem. And one of the main things you need with random attack is you need a very reliable test for completion. So I'll give you a little example of this. When I was working on the TiVo, I needed to work out how to get PAL output. And I needed to work out how to convince this particular chip in the TiVo to get PAL output. And I knew how to detect PAL input because I knew that I'd already worked out that chip. So I knew which bit on the chip on the input side told me when I had PAL. So the trick was to loop back a cable from the output of the TiVo to the input of the TiVo. And then you write a program that watches for the PAL bit on the input. And then you have a program, Paul hooked up a reset line to the CPU on the TiVo so that I could reset it. Then I had a little expect script that tried each possible bit in the range of registers available in the output chip until such time as the input side got PAL. And in fact, what it did also is it recorded every trial that it had, and when it crashed the machine, then it would eliminate that one from further trials. And it would first try all single-bit register sets, then dual-bit register sets, etc. And then what you do is you just leave it to run. It tries lots of random combinations. And then eventually, you know, the little program goes beep, 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 beep. It's just got PAL on the input. But one thing that I'd warn about, this particular one I did with the TiVo taught me a bit of a lesson, because you may not find the solution you in fact want. You may find a solution that is correct for your test, but may not in fact be the ideal solution you want. And it turned out that when I was doing this on the TiVo, in fact, I didn't correctly set the PAL bit. I correctly set a turn off error checking type bit that happened to end up giving data that was interpreted as PAL. So in fact, you've got to be very careful with your test for completions. You also need to reduce the scope of possible inputs as far as you can. So if you can prove to yourself that a particular range of inputs isn't going to be needed, then try to exclude it. And it's probably a good idea to do a rough back of the envelope calculation on how long the random attack is going to take. Because if it's going to take, you know, more than your lifetime, then it may be worth trying a different route. Okay, so dual server techniques. I mentioned earlier about dual server techniques and backtracking technique. Dual server techniques are one of my favorite, and they're extremely powerful way of fine-tuning your knowledge of a particular protocol. It's really only useful once you have a fair bit of knowledge about the protocol already. So the basic idea is you write yourself a client that attaches to two servers at once. And typically one of them is your server, your not quite perfect implementation, and the assumed correct implementation, the proprietary implementation. And then what you do is you generate random requests to both servers in parallel, sending exactly the same request to both servers. And then the client looks for any differences in the responses between the two. It has to know what differences are significant. So for example, the two servers, when you open a file, one might return a different file descriptor number to the other. That's not significant. It doesn't matter whether what you return file descriptor 36 or 37. In fact, you need to keep that mapping inside the client. If, for example, one server returns an error for an operation, the other server doesn't return an error, then that is significant. And so you need to be able to work out exactly which things are significant in the differences in return between the two servers, and then you compare the results and from that work out where, in fact, your server, your implementation is going wrong. Now, we've used this in a number of places in Samba. This was initially used for the working out the wildcarding algorithms. In the SME protocol, it has five wildcard characters rather than the usual two. And so the less than, greater than, and double quote are wildcard characters in the SME protocol, as well as the star and question mark, which you're probably more familiar with. You don't see that on the command line. It's generated internally in the client. That is why those characters aren't allowed in file names, because if you use them in a file name, then of course it would be rather confusing because they end up as some sort of wildcard on the server. Anyway, so when we first used this working out the wildcard matching algorithm we had our reference server that had our guess at the input, at the wildcard matching, and then we had the reference server, and then we looked at differences. That gave us very quickly sets of examples of where a file name and wildcard pattern didn't match, and from that we could very quickly work out what the algorithm was supposed to be. It took a few days, but it wasn't a particularly hard task. Now that task was made easier from the fact that there was no propagation of the problem through the, say, one packet didn't affect a packet 100 later, because you're able to, between operations, delete the file and you're back with a clean slate, which is the problem that was pointed out before. But the next task we had, we weren't quite so lucky. We wanted to work out how byte range locking worked in the SMB protocol. And it's rather bizarre. We knew it was fairly bizarre. We had an implementation that we thought was fairly sensible, but in fact wasn't at all accurate. And so what we needed to do was work out exactly how byte range locking worked. And for that, we needed to explore a huge number of combinations of possible locks and unlocks. We knew, for example, that locking stacked in the SMB protocol, so that when you had one lock, you could overlay it with another and another and another, and then you can remove them one at a time. It's quite different to the POSIX protocol, where there's only one bit of information per byte. Anyway, so we came up with this technique, dual server backtracking. And the basic idea is this. You record all operations as they're sent to each server. When an error occurs, you replay the operations, replay the set of operations with some of them removed. So you pick some subset of the operations and you remove them, and then you try it again. Now, if when you remove those operations, the server no longer gives an error, no longer gives a difference between the two, the two servers no longer behave differently, then you know that those operations were critical, were on the critical path to causing a difference in behavior between the two servers. If, however, when you remove those operations, you still get the error, then you know that those operations weren't critical and you leave them out of the pool. So you can keep removing chunks of operations, and you can do it in roughly log n time, so you can remove of the order of half the operations at a time and slowly narrow down how many operations you're removing per go, and eventually come up with the minimum subset of operations that cause a difference between the two servers. So we do this in this program called LockTest, and it opens two connections to each server, Each connection it opens as two file opens to the same file, so there's four files open, and it generates random lock and unlock and reopen requests, so close and open again, and it generates random offsets and links and randomly whether it's a read or write lock, and then it does the backtracking to generate the minimum subset. So I can show you that briefly. Let's see, I should be able to have it in my history. There it is. There's lock test. Okay. So I run lock test against these two servers. And in fact, this is an early version of Windows, an early version of Windows 2000 without service packs. In fact, there will be a difference between the two. And that difference is quite illuminating. It's a serious locking bug in the first release of Windows 2000. And Microsoft only discovered this because we showed it to them. And so, in fact, if you're running an unpatched version of Windows, you may find sometimes you'll get data corruption because of this bug. Anyway, so what we're seeing here is it's connected to twice to each server, and then it's doing an operation here. You see on connection 1, file descriptor 0, so second connection, first file descriptor, it's doing a 5-byte lock at offset 63. Then it's, it's a 63-byte lock at offset 5. And it's doing a write lock, and both servers gave NT status OK. So both servers OK'd that operation. So we keep going down, we have hundreds and hundreds of operations, and then eventually the client that's generating these operations will notice that the servers behave differently in some way. And so we wander down here, it'll happen eventually. There it is. Right. So we can see there, if I just go up a little bit, right, this operation here, then we can see that the first server gave a lock not granted. That's the Windows 2000 service that refused this lock, which is the 2-byte lock at offset 75, whereas the Samba server said, yes, I'll accept that lock. Now, when we were first developing this program, we would have just assumed it was a Samba bug. But as we got it narrowed down and down and down, and we got a better and better implementation of our locking, we eventually came across cases like this, where, in fact, it wasn't a Samba bug, it was a Windows bug. And so that particular lock, of course, just from that operation where, you know, 1,000 operations into this or 685 operations into this. So trying to analyze that by hand, that combination of 685 locks over a small range of a file, would be a complete nightmare. So what it does now is it tries eliminating 0 to 341. So it eliminates half the locks and then runs the test again. And then, depending on the result of that, it eliminates different ranges. And eventually, it will come down and narrow it down to the absolute minimum number of locks that are available. So in a few seconds, it'll have got that. Normally, you don't run it in such a verbose manner. It normally just prints the final result. But I'm running this in a very verbose manner so that you can see roughly how the system works. So it's down to about 10 locks or so. It also does tests for whether it's reproducible. So while it's doing this, it will rerun some tests to confirm that, in fact, the server is being deterministic. Because if the server is not being deterministic for a particular pattern of locks, then this technique just doesn't work. So it's worthwhile doing some confirmation of that. There it is. Okay. So it's got it down to a pattern of 4 locks at the end here. And the 4 locks are a lock at offset 48 of length 42, a read lock, both of them said it's okay. Then it does at offset 29, 22, a read lock, both of them are okay at. Then we see a reopen. Now it's a reopen of connection 1 file descriptor run 1, and then we try to do a write lock. Now when you reopen a file, it's supposed to destroy the lock on that file. And what happened here was Windows 2000 sometimes, in some particular circumstances, forgets to remove the lock when you close a file. And that means somebody else comes along later and tries to open the file and access it, and in fact they end up not being able to access the data in the file because it's mandatory locking, not advisory locking in SMB. So they're refused access to the data even though they've got the file open for exclusive access. And that can be very, very confusing for an application, and it could cause data corruption. So anyway, once we showed this, of course, to Microsoft, they then went and fixed it in the later service packs. But it's the technique, we've used this technique a lot to, there's another thing the 0-0 bug, in fact I'm basically done here. Let's just try and get towards the end. We also discovered some rather interesting things with the 0-0 lock. That's a lock at offset 0 of length 0. There's some very strange behaviour. So final slide, there's some general advice if you're interested in taking on these types of problems. Make sure you always confirm your assumptions. If you're making any assumptions about how things work, write a little program that confirms the assumption. You often learn something very useful from doing that. Make sure you build up a library of captures so you can go back and reference them later and call them something obvious as to what they're doing. You should build both a client and a server, because you'll find that if you're trying to actually implement a server, having your own client is very, very powerful. Start with very malleable throwaway code that's easy to modify. Don't try and write perfectly structured code initially, because perfectly structured code, it can be harder to make the code do the incorrect thing. And doing the wrong thing is often as useful as doing the right thing. You don't need to be a great programmer to do this sort of thing. You just need an awful lot of persistence. This is my first attempt at network programming when I started on Samba. And I was a physicist by background, not a computer scientist. So please, if you're interested in doing this type of thing, don't let lack of experience put you off. And so good luck.